You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up January 21st is set to be Donald Trump's first full day in office. It may also be the biggest mobilization in response to an inauguration in history. We'll find out more.
First, we're getting the details of a big meeting today on health insurance for state workers. Today, the board overseeing state worker health benefits, called the Group Insurance Board, met to decide whether or not to pursue self-insurance for state workers. This afternoon, they announced that they would not take action on self-insurance today. The group plans to continue the discussion about self-insurance next month.
David Wahlberg is here to share the details of this news and put it in context. He's a health reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. David, welcome back to the show.
Hi, it's good to be here.
So this issue has been percolating out there for a while. A lot of talk. Are they going to shift over to self-insurance or not? Tensions heat up. Are they going to do it at the meeting today? And then, no, delayed, postponed. What happened?
Well, yeah, and actually, initially, they were supposed to vote on this last month, and then that got delayed to this month, and now it's been delayed till January. You know, the board discussed some of the issues this morning in open session, and then they went into closed session and discussed it in more detail. They came back out in open session at 2:40 this afternoon, and just very briefly said that they didn't take any action and they would continue deliberations in January. So they really didn't give much detail about why this delay.
And as I understand it, this isn't just a yes-no question. There are actually seven different alternatives on the table. Can you outline the basic concept, though, of self-insurance for us? What would that mean?
Yeah, so in general, self-insurance is a model where employers pay for medical care directly themselves, and then if there's risk, if there's large claims, they have to absorb the risk for that, as opposed to fully insured, in which employers hire insurance companies to basically take on that risk, and then they pay them the premiums. And so, yes, this board is sort of considering a range of things that might involve self-insurance on a statewide level or perhaps just in a few regions. And then they're also looking at this idea of regionalization itself. So right now, the 17 health plans that are involved in the state worker program can basically decide where they want to offer insurance, which counties they want to work in. Under this regionalization issue, there would be sort of set regions, four regions in the state, and the insurers would have to offer insurance throughout those regions.
And the bottom line here is, I guess, the bottom line itself, the hope being that if this change was made, it would save money for the state. What have we heard about whether that would actually happen?
Yeah, well, that is one of the main goals, is to reduce costs, to save money. The state has also said that they're looking to have more control over the data on workers so they can sort of see what deal they're getting. Right now, they don't have much control over that because it's basically owned by the insurance companies. And in terms of whether this would save money or not, there's been consultant reports that have basically said it could cost more. It could cost up to $100 million a year more, or it could save about $40 million a year.
Talking to David Wahlberg about today's Group Insurance Board meeting here in the state, the non-decision when it comes to switching to self-insurance for coverage of state employees. I have here, Shemaine Mills, a reporter here, gave me a letter from the co-chairs of the Joint Finance Committee, Senator Alberta Darling, Representative John Nygren, saying, in effect, hey, Group Insurance Board, we have concerns about this. I'm paraphrasing there. They say they want to save money, but they're worried that, quoting here, a move to regionalization would create artificial government boundaries and maybe affect viable, already functioning marketplaces. Was this cited as a reason, or are people thinking this might be a reason for the delay by the Group Insurance Board today?
Right. This letter came out yesterday, and it was addressed to the board chairman, Michael Farrell. I asked him about that right after the meeting today, and he wouldn't comment about whether this letter influenced their decision to delay. But in a broader sense, you might sort of think about healthcare and how complex it is and how political it can be. Just look now at the discussion with whether to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and there's all sorts of complexities going on with that, with the next Congress and the president-elect. And look back to 2009 when Congress and the Obama administration set up the Affordable Care Act. That was also very complicated and very political. So I think this letter may indicate that the same things are true on a smaller scale here in Wisconsin. And, you know, these health plans are owned by regional health systems around the state, and so they have strong constituencies in lots of parts of Wisconsin. And so legislators are concerned about what the impact might be on the health systems.
And in that case, if it impacts the health systems, that might not just affect state employees who are directly affected by self-insurance. It might lead to changes for people who use those same providers. Is that right?
Potentially, yeah. So in Wisconsin, in terms of the fully insured market, so that's the model where the employer hires an insurance company to pay benefits, state workers are about 15% of that market. So whatever the state decides to do about those workers, if it carves them out of that market, that could have a big impact on the insurers and thus the health systems that own them, especially in places like Dane County where, you know, most of the state workers are.
Now, if the group insurance board had arrived at a decision today, or if they arrive at one in January for that matter, is that it? Is that the done deal? Are they the decider, or does that have to go to the Joint Finance Committee or the legislature as a whole?
If they adopt self-insurance in any way, then that would go to the Joint Finance Committee. They have sort of a passive review. So if they're okay with it, they can just do nothing and it would happen. But if they want to have a hearing on it or have some role in this, which seems to be likely, especially, you know, given things like this letter that you just referred to, then they could do that.
And as I mentioned earlier, this wasn't just a thumbs up, thumbs down on self-insurance. There were seven different proposals. I assume it would take us most of the day to go through all the fine points, but can you spell out kind of the spectrum? What are some of the different permutations that were on the table here?
Well, if you kind of think of it as a spectrum, the status quo or sort of close to the status quo is one of the options, basically allowing all these insurers to still participate, although the state is still planning to make some changes, even if they decide to do that. For example, they want to start setting rates for insurers instead of allowing the insurers to set the rates. And then on the other end of the spectrum would be completely self-insured and maybe just having one or two companies run that program statewide. But actually, the Department of Employee Trust Funds recommended against that sort of most radical option. So in between are various degrees of these regions and also the potential for sort of some self-insurance or all self-insurance. And, you know, the regions kind of vary from requiring regions throughout the state and maybe just having one insurer or one or two insurers in each region. But then some of the options would essentially allow things to stay the same, for example, in the southern part of the state, but then make more changes in other parts of the state. It gets a little confusing.
Sure. And tell us a little bit about the group insurance board. Who are they and who appoints them?
I don't have it right off the top of my head, but it's largely controlled by the governor. Several appointees are made by the governor, and some are basically administrative people. And I can't remember if it's 11 or 13 members, but it's something like that. And most of them have some role in their working lives with insurance, or they are represent state workers themselves.
And then what happens? They've postponed this decision until January. What are they looking for when it comes to more information, more data between now and then?
Yeah, well, Chairman Farrell basically said that they that the board had asked staff and the consultants that the state has hired to look into this to provide more information. The board wasn't scheduled to meet again until February, but they are planning to have a special meeting in January. They haven't announced the date yet, but they're wanting to move forward with this, apparently, quickly enough that they've decided to schedule this special meeting. And, you know, initially, state officials had said that they really needed to make a decision this calendar year, so in 2016, in order for these changes to occur at the beginning of 2018, which has been the target all along. You know, now that it's moving into early next year, one wonders if that still could happen. But I did ask Lisa Ellinger with ETF, who is kind of overseeing this, whether the changes could still occur at the beginning of 2018 if a decision isn't made till next month, and she said yes.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be here.
That's David Wahlberg, health reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He joined us to talk about the Group Insurance Board's decision to postpone a decision on self-insurance for state employees.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, so far, three generals have been nominated to key advisory roles in President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet and White House staff. We'll talk about what generals will bring to the White House and what it could mean for Trump's approach to governing.
First, January 21st is scheduled to be Donald Trump's first full day in office. It may also be the day of the biggest mobilization this country has seen in response to a presidential inauguration.
The planned Women's March on Washington is set for the 21st. It already has over 100,000 dedicated marchers, according to Facebook numbers. According to organizers, the march is a rally, not a protest, trying to make the point that women's rights are human rights. That's a line the march is borrowing from a speech by Hillary Clinton.
Emily Crockett is with us now. She's a staff writer covering gender issues at Vox.com, where she wrote a piece called The Women's March on Washington Explained. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, can you tell us where the idea for this march came from?
Well, it emerged in a very grassroots, organic way on Facebook. And this is according to organizers, who the march now has organizers. It's evolved quite a bit since it first began, but it actually started in the pro-Hillary Clinton Pantsuit Nation secret Facebook group. This is a massive group. It has like 4 million members, which started as a pro-Hillary Clinton group for people who were excited to elect the first woman president, and has morphed into kind of a political organizing group and a place for people to share their stories and grieve and all of that. So a grandmother, apparently, she first invited, you know, 40 of her friends to march in Washington against, Trump with her. And then that call went viral. And so that ended up on the Pantsuit Nation, Facebook group. And then from there, you know, there were just so many members there that it just spread. Then there were a whole bunch of other marches. You know, women were just spreading the word and saying that this seems like a great idea to march in Washington against Trump because a lot of women fear for their civil liberties in a Trump administration. He is an alleged serial sexual predator. It's not clear that he will do much, if anything, for women's rights and that he might roll them back, whether it's reproductive rights or protections for women in the workplace. So women, and there's also just the frustration and the anger over having the chance to elect the first woman president, who is also a feminist who highlights women's issues, to have that chance taken away from them. And so there's a lot of energy behind it.
It's interesting because the way you describe it, it sounds like a march against Donald Trump and what could be the agenda with women in his presidency. But on the other hand, it sounds like people who are taking part don't want to call it a protest per se. They want to call it something else. So what is this march?
Right. Well, yes, they are absolutely calling it a rally and a march rather than a protest. For practical purposes, I think a lot of people are motivated by protesting Trump, but the message of the rally is an affirmative one. It is, you know, The official statement says that it is affirming that women's rights are human rights. And the sad truth is, I think, that when you say that, it shouldn't be a partisan statement, but of course, that is a famous line from Hillary Clinton's speech in China, that women's rights are human rights. And it's certainly an implicit critique of Trump, which suggests that, you know, that he may not consider women's rights to be human rights, or but the positive framing there is to send a message to the Trump administration that if it wasn't planning to prioritize women's rights and women's lives before, it definitely should consider doing so now. Now there are other events that are explicit protests. There have been strikes. There was supposed to be one yesterday. Women protesting the election results, but these particular marches are more affirmative of women's lives and rights and the issues that women want to fight for. It's more for that than explicitly against Trump, but certainly there is an anti-Trump element to it.
Now, it sounds like over 100,000 people on Facebook already say that they're planning to attend. Now, these are Facebook confirmations. It doesn't mean these are set in stone. But if that is the case, that it is 100,000 people, perhaps more, where would that place this particular march in history against other mobilizations like it?
It would certainly be it would be a pretty historically large march. So it would definitely be the biggest mobilization specifically around a presidential inauguration that we've seen. There were tens of thousands of protesters against Nixon in the heyday of the Vietnam era. There were also a number of protesters against George W. Bush's first inauguration over the Supreme Court issue. And the other aspect here is where it sits in the history of marches on Washington. So it is called the Women's March on Washington. It was originally going to be called the Million Women's March, but they quickly realized that that would be not the best idea because there was already a Million Women's March in 1997, specifically of black women in Philadelphia. And so the organizers realized they said that would probably not be respectful to use that same name. And there are some in the group who say that using the March on Washington name at all is sort of an appropriation of Martin Luther King's 1963 March on Washington. The organizers, by the way, they were all white women to begin with, and there were some diversity issues and critiques related to that. But since then, they have put together a pretty diverse group of co-chairs. The three of the four co-chairs are women of color activists, many of whom led a march against police brutality and for criminal justice reform. They say that the March in Washington, that using that name, you know, that other notable marches have also use that framing, and that they are explicitly honoring Dr. King, that they are promoting the Kingian principles of nonviolence, that they are continuing in his tradition rather than trying to sort of, you know, erase and appropriate his work.
We're talking with Emily Crockett right now, staff writer covering gender issues at Vox.com, talking about the upcoming March on Washington, Women's March on Washington, which is set for January 21st. And Emily, in your piece, it sounds like part of this may have been that some women had plane tickets to go to Washington to see, they thought, Hillary Clinton, the first woman president, be inaugurated. And now they may want to use those plane tickets, not have to lose out on that, but are doing something else. Is that part of this? People have already had the travel plans.
Oh, that's definitely part of it. I don't know if that's actually the primary motivator, but I think it's definitely something that will get a lot of people down there who maybe wouldn't have already gone. But I've also heard, anecdotally at least, a lot of stories from people who have bought plane tickets specifically for this march, including, you know, people whose mothers have never marched in any protest before, but they think that this is important enough that they're going to fly to Washington, D.C. and do this.
Do we know anything about the rest of the program? Apparently, there will also be entertainers, speakers, a lot of the other sorts of highlights of this sort of mobilization. Is any of that out there yet?
Not that I've seen. A lot of the program is still in the works. The other thing that's in the works and that has been causing a lot of controversy and confusion is actually just the basic permit issues. There were some headlines ricocheting around the internet saying that the Women's March would be barred from the Lincoln Memorial as if it was, like, specifically targeted at them. This isn't the case. The Park Service is going to be building a big stage at the Lincoln Memorial for inauguration. It's going to take time to dismantle that, and it's just going to be a big construction site, apparently, that probably would not be safe for 100,000 people to march through. Nonetheless, there's some controversy over, you know, whether people's free speech rights are being infringed upon through this by the Park Service.
Emily,
go ahead.
But the
organizers are saying that the permits have not been secured yet, but they will be. It will just be at a different location nearby the Lincoln Memorial, and they're telling people, don't change your flights. This is definitely happening, and they're in conversations with the Park Service now.
Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Emily Crockett, staff writer covering gender issues for Vox.com. And she's joining us there to talk about the upcoming Women's March on Washington, which is scheduled for January 21st.
Coming up, President-elect Donald Trump has named three generals so far to top roles in his upcoming administration. We'll talk about the unique intersection of the military and the White House coming up in just a bit. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, it's this week's edition of Latino USA. Tonight, stories of people fitting into new environments and how Latino youth navigate the worlds of high school and elementary school. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
Now, President-elect Donald Trump's White House team is beginning to take a clearer shape as we head closer to Inauguration Day. The cabinet and staff include CEOs like Rex Tillerson, Republican stalwarts like Betsy DeVos, and others from the world of business and politics.
But one emerging trend is the presence of retired generals in key security posts. So far, Trump has named Marine General John Kelly to lead the Department of Homeland Security, retired Marine General James Mattis to lead the Department of Defense, and former Army Lieutenant General Michael Flynn to be his national security advisor.
Nora Benzahel joins us now. She's a distinguished scholar in residence at the School of International Service at American University. Nora, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Before we look at the generals one at a time, what do you make of this very significant role of generals in the shaping up Trump administration?
Well, I think it's unexpected. I don't think anybody expected that we'd be seeing quite this many retired generals already named to the cabinet or to very influential advisory positions. I do think that it reflects what seems to be Donald Trump's great respect for the military and also a real desire to bring in some outsiders into his administration. People in the military, especially generals at that level, retired generals, are very, very different than the kind of people that Donald Trump would usually run into as a businessman. I have a colleague who referred to these retired generals as alien life forms to someone like Donald Trump, coming from a very, very different world, different set of values, but also generals have a reputation for being able to get things done, and I think that's something something that, you know, he does have in common with the business world and something that the president-elect seems to respect.
You mentioned Donald Trump's respect for the military. People have also pointed toward a public respect for the military in a time when a lot of institutions, Congress, big business, the media, and even Donald Trump doesn't have great approval ratings. So maybe linking himself to this institution that gets respect might be a boost to his administration.
It certainly is true that the U.S. military has been, and for a long time, and remains the most respected institution in the country. There's years and years of survey data going back at least a couple of decades that shows that that's been true. On the other hand, I'm not sure that that's necessarily the reason why Trump is appointing them. He's picking some rather controversial people for other positions. So I'm not sure how much of this is a political calculation on his part to try to draw off of the popularity of these generals, and how much of it reflects, you know, great respect for these individuals and for wanting to put together a team, particularly in the national security realm, because that's where most of these retired generals will be serving if confirmed, that have that kind of background.
Now, this is not unprecedented. There have been generals and other military brass in key White House positions. The biggest looming example in recent memory, Colin Powell as a Secretary of State. Does he give some precedent here?
Yes, there certainly is precedent, but it's hard to remember a time. I certainly can't come up with any examples where you had the prospect of so many retired generals and admirals serving at the same time. There certainly are precedents, as you said. General Powell is one of them, someone who served as National Security Advisor in the earliest President Bush administration, George W. Brent Scowcroft, who was a retired general who very, very well respected and was doing a tremendously good job as National Security Advisor. But at the moment, we have three who've been named, two of whom require Senate confirmation, and it seems likely that there will be a fourth because Mike Rogers, his name has been floated as the Director of National Intelligence. So I can't remember a time when there were that many prospective retired generals and admirals serving within, you know, the cabinet or equivalent positions.
Let's start looking at some of the generals in particular. General Kelly as Director of Homeland Security. I was going to say the biggest position, but there's Department of Defense here, too. But this was a big appointment. This is a really big a hybrid agency. It does a lot of different stuff. What are people saying about General Kelly, his background, and how it would fit him in this position?
Well, his background, I think, particularly plays to some of the substantive issues that go on within the Department of Homeland Security. He was the combatant commander in charge of Southern Command, which looks at Central and South American issues. And there was largely responsible for military support to many countries in the drug war and doing other things there. I think that experience is probably one of the reasons why he was an attractive candidate, particularly for the Department of Homeland Security.
And it doesn't seem like he's been a controversial appointment for the most part.
No, I haven't heard people say negative things about him. I don't think any of the individuals who have been named, with the possible exception of Mike Flynn, who is controversial because of his role in the campaign, but I don't think that the issue that some people are having has anything to do with the individual qualifications. Now it seems to be that, you know, the large number of them and the fact that if you have the three retired generals who've been named, again, as I mentioned, a possible fourth one for the Director of National Intelligence, you know, is it a problem to have people not just from the military but all from the same background as the main people in charge of your foreign and defense policy? Some people are questioning whether that undermines the principle of civilian control over the military and, you know, the role that retired generals play in society. I'm not so concerned about that. I think that the principle of civilian control over the military is very well enshrined and respected. But I do think it raises a lot of questions about a militarized approach to U.S. foreign policy. And again, diversity in viewpoints and background is well known as being essential to good decision making. Having lots of people who've worn stars on their shoulders being in charge of national security policy may not be, you know, the most diverse group of people to have debates and discussions about the way forward on some very complicated national security issues.
Talking to Nora Bensahel from American University, looking at the role of general generals in the Trump administration. Nora, before we get back to the other particular generals, you'd written before the election, we kind of saw these dueling endorsements, both candidates brandishing X number of generals and admirals endorsing them. You wrote with a colleague that you would like to see generals and admirals not do that, to make a very specific decision to not endorse candidates, not get so directly involved in politics. Why is that?
Yeah, I wrote that piece with a colleague who is named Dave Varno, who is a retired Army three-star general. And both of us feel very deeply that it is not appropriate for retired general officers and admirals to endorse candidates because it politicizes their role in the process. One of the things that General Dunford, the Marine general who currently serves as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has talked about is reminding military members to remain apolitical. That hasn't so much been a problem for people on active duty, but it's a problem when people of such high renown at such a senior level start endorsing candidates, because it raises the prospect of politicized generals and the process of appointing senior military officers based on what their personal politics may be or what they may be likely to say when they leave office. To the extent that if you as a president believe that whoever you pick is your chairman or is the chief of staff of the Army or whatever other senior position it may be, if you believe that when they leave office they're going to endorse candidates, it may shade your view of who you appoint to those positions. And, as we wrote, there are no Republican generals or Democratic generals. They're just American generals, and they need to stay in that apolitical role even after they retire.
So does having generals on a cabinet start to erode that too?
I don't think it does quite as much, although I do think there's still a concern there as well. One of the things that has been noted in many of the news articles is that the three folks who have been named and appointed so far are all people who had conflicts with the Obama administration over various policies. And that's particularly true of General Mike Flynn, who's a retired lieutenant general, who's going to be the National Security Advisor, but even General Mattis, the nominee for the Secretary of Defense, had fallings out with the Obama administration over particular policies, over, emphasis in Flynn's case about the extent of the threat of ISIS, in Mattis's case, the potential threats from Iran. And so I do think that you have, that dynamic to some extent here as well. But it's particularly egregious when it comes to endorsing political candidates. At least here, these generals are serving when their, president has asked them to serve. Endorsing candidates is a little bit of a different phenomenon.
We're talking to Nora Ben-Zahel, distinguished scholar in residence at the School of International Service at American University, looking at President-elect Donald Trump's nominations of three generals so far to key positions in his administration.
And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think of Donald Trump's decision to nominate generals to his cabinet? Should military officials serve in political roles, or do you think that the military and former officers should be apolitical? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation about President-elect Donald Trump's choice to name three retired generals so far to high-level roles in his administration, and how this compares to previous cabinets and what it says about his potential governing style.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these appointments? A lot of top brass coming to the White House, it looks like. Do you think military officials should take cabinet-level roles? What role do you hope they do or don't play in important security decision-making? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation with Nora Ben-Zahel. She's a distinguished scholar in residence at the School of International Service at American University.
And Nora, one wrinkle here is that, as I understand it, currently federal law doesn't let a retired general serve as the Department of the Secretary of Defense, doesn't let them be in charge of the Pentagon. Why is that, and what would have to happen to allow that?
Well, the law requires that anybody who's a retired general or who has served in the military be out of the military for at least 7 years before becoming Secretary of Defense. And that was put in place for a very important reason, to ensure that there is a civilian who is always in charge of the Department of Defense.
I'm going to cut in. Your line is kind of breaking up for us, Nora. We'll put you on hold for just a moment and see if we can quickly reestablish that. And again, you can join in with your thoughts on appointments of former generals, retired generals to key national security positions at 800-642-1234. Nora Bensahel with us, hoping to reconnect with her as the phone line was breaking up there. She's at American University. In the meantime, we can get some of your thoughts on that. We'll go to John with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if your guest, I know that your guest agrees that generals shouldn't make public endorsements, but are they able to, would she agree that they're still able to do private conversations with friends about politics?
John?
Is that still something she agrees to?
John, thanks for the call. So, Nora, John saying, endorsements aside, is it appropriate for generals to express opinions, I guess, in private, not maybe on the campaign trail?
Yeah, I think that's a very appropriate role, and I think that's something that often happens if a candidate or a serving president asks for advice and input. I think that is a fairly normal state of affairs. It's the public endorsement. It's the taking of a public position that I think poses the real challenges for the future. Retired General Marty Dempsey, whose most recent position was as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff before General Dunford took that office, you know, made the point in a piece that he wrote, when retired generals endorse candidates, they don't do so in their personal capacity. They don't do so as, you know, Mike or John or whatever their first name is. You know, what they do is, you know, their first name is for all intents and purposes general or admiral. And I do think that makes a very big difference in the public sphere.
John, thanks for that call. Nora, one thought I've seen is people say, hey, don't assume because these are generals here that they're going to be reaching for a military option first and foremost. They may not be more prone to intervention. They understand maybe more than most civilians do the costs of military intervention. Is there a thought that maybe these would be a restraining hand for military action by the United States?
Yeah, I think that there is. You know, that is the general impression that, you know, people who served in the military do know the cost and are more hesitant. That said, they also generally like to have a freer hand in the conduct of military operations than civilian political leaders often want them to. That is a normal part of our system. There's been lots written on that as part of the civil-military dynamic in the United States, and some tension there is deliberately built into the system. So I do think that there are some concerns that, you know, that normal civilian oversight, that civilian perspective that makes sure that the military means are calibrated with the political ends, that function may be somewhat undermined or less present than if you had people who were pure civilians who had, you know, weren't coming out serving as generals before taking these offices.
Time for one more call. We've got Sam on the line in Menominee. Sam, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling to express my support for General Mattis and General Kelly. I've met both of them personally through my father. He's a retired Marine Corps general, a Marine Corps colonel. And I just think that they'll be really good picks, especially where our national security is concerned. Of course, we may or may not have issues where they're getting their marching orders from. I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Sam, thanks a lot for the call. So it sounds like he likes these picks, and he said, I believe he was alluding to not sure about their boss, the person appointing them. And briefly as we wrap up, Nora, is this maybe reassuring some people who doubted Donald Trump's experience and judgment on national security issues?
I think it is in the Department of Defense, in the particular case of General Mattis, and I think that's why he's likely to be confirmed and get the waiver he needs to serve as the Secretary of Defense, even though he's only been out of uniform for 4 years instead of the required 7. He is incredibly well-respected both inside and outside the department, and I think on the national security realm, there were a lot of concerns about some of the statements and policy views that candidate Trump espoused during the campaign, and I think that within the Department of Defense and within a lot of national security watchers out there. There's a lot of optimism that General Mattis, as the Secretary of Defense, will be providing particularly useful and wise counsel in that realm.
We'll leave it there. Nora, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Nora Bensahel, a distinguished scholar in residence at the School of International Service at American University, looking at the role of generals in the upcoming Trump administration.
It starts as a ticket for a small traffic violation like a parking infraction or a headlight being out. Some recipients don't have the ability to pay, and it snowballs into more, a suspended license or worse, a warrant for their arrest.
Ross Terrell reports that three City of Milwaukee judges gave people a chance to clear their record during the first three Wednesdays of November.
It's the second warrant withdrawal Wednesday of the month, and hundreds of people are waiting in line outside the municipal courthouse for the chance to clear their record. Victoria Porter is one of them. Her driver's license was suspended after she failed to pay a ticket for her taillight being out. She says the Wednesday initiative is fantastic, and she is glad so many people are taking advantage of it.
I'm proud of this because it shows me that people ain't trying to be out here, you know, being the illegal or being criminals or whatever the labels they want to give us. We just want to be right and get on with our lives.
Porter says not having a license has added stress to her everyday life.
It causes me in my own mind to be like nervous, like, oh, they're going to, you know, I'm going to get in trouble because I don't, you know, have my license together. And I'm responsible for that. Like, I know I should have paid my tickets, but I'm building my business. So if I didn't have, you know, the funds for that, this is a good opportunity for me to, like, come and clear myself up.
Three City of Milwaukee judges gave people a chance to right their wrongs and get their life back on track. The judges say the initial plan was to give people throughout the county a chance to have warrants lifted or turn themselves in for more serious offenses without being arrested. That plan became too complicated, so they decided instead to just lift warrants and end driver's license suspensions in the city. Philip Chavez is one of those judges. He says this effort gives the court a chance to get to know the person behind the warrant or suspension.
That's been a problem, is that once they receive a citation or a violation, they don't come in. We don't know your situation at that point, obviously. It's just a name in the system. Now, in an event like this, we can get them actually into court. We can see them, discuss their options.
One small payment during this day in court gives people a 90-day extension on all their cases. Molly Collins is the associate director of the ACLU of Wisconsin. She says people need other options in case they still can't pay after the 90 days.
There has to be another way for people to address these issues if they really just don't have the money to pay the tickets. I mean, in the 53206 zip code, the average income is like $21,000. That does not leave a lot of free money around to pay a ticket for driving with a suspended license.
On these Wednesdays, people can accept a 24-month payment plan, elect to perform community service, or enter a drug treatment, mental health, or job search program. Ramon Hall appeared in court to clear up his driving record. He took advantage of the job search option and says it's a good first step, but hopefully in the future more could be done.
I still have to go through to see exactly what I have to do to get the fines paid. They're lifting the warrants, but the fines are still there. So with that being said, you know, maybe if they can reduce fines, maybe cut them in half, maybe, you know, a percentage of it, that'd be even better.
Collins of the ACLU says the impact of these warrants stretches beyond an individual.
People are obviously going to be less likely to call the police if they need help, if they have a warrant, or less likely to report some other sort of crime in their neighborhood if they have a bunch of tickets or an outstanding warrant.
Judge Valerie Hill says she can only hope this has a positive impact on police and community relations.
That's part of the reason we wanted to do it, is because we wanted to take away some of the barriers that are there for employment, some of the reasons that people make bad decisions when it comes to police interaction. So we tried to do our part in lifting some of the barriers for people.
Hill says the effort is unexpectedly bringing in money for the city because most people are choosing to pay. She says based off the success of the more than 7,000 lifted warrants and licenses reinstated over the first three Wednesdays, they hope to do events like this again in the future. Ross Terrell, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.